As an appellate lawyer, David R. Dow has represented more than 100 death row inmates over the last 20 years. He's also a distinguished professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the litigation director at the Texas Defender Service. In his latest book, The Autobiography of an Execution, he gives us his personal take on the justice system, the death penalty, and his experiences as a lawyer representing men and women condemned to die. It's published by 12, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Dow to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Where does Texas stand in trying death penalty cases? My sense as a New Yorker is it's number one in the country. Is that true?
Texas is not only number one in the country, it is in a league of its own. It carries out somewhere between half and two-thirds of all of the executions that are carried out in the U.S.
So other states may very well, somebody might be condemned to death, put on death row, and then for one reason or another, never be executed.
That's correct. When I started representing death row inmates about 20 years ago, Texas and California had death rows of about equal size. They had about 350 people each on death row. Today, California has more than 700 on death row, and Texas still has about 350. And the reason
so those 700 are really serving life sentences for all intents and purposes.
I think that over the last 20 years, California's carried out three executions and Texas has carried out 450.
Now, is that because of the attitude of residents of the state or is it because of the way the governors handle death cases?
I think that it's a variety of factors. I think that the most important factor is that Texas has gotten very good at carrying out executions, and that means that all of the different cogs in the machine are very efficient at doing their jobs, and in other states that carry out fewer, that's not the case.
Have you become a specialist? How did you start working on these cases?
I started working on one of these cases sort of by accident. I agreed to represent someone who was unrepresented and who was scheduled to be executed in 2 weeks' time.
Derek Raymond.
And back in those days, death row inmates were not entitled to lawyers, so they had to count on volunteers. They didn't have any legal right to a lawyer.
And in his case, what was the state when you took over?
He was 2 weeks away from an execution date, and his lawyer, who had been representing him up until that time, just decided that he wasn't going to do anything else for him.
Well, he had fallen asleep in court, that lawyer. He didn't file paperwork on time. How can a lawyer in a capital case fall asleep without that causing a stir in the courtroom?
I couldn't tell you how it can happen without it causing a stir. I can tell you how it happens. It happens because the lawyer comes to court every morning having had the equivalent of three or four New Year's Eve celebrations the night before. The astonishing thing is not that there are alcoholics who are practicing law and representing clients. The astonishing thing is that those alcoholics are appointed to represent clients by trial judges, and the trial judges then sit there at their bench and look at that lawyer while that lawyer's eyes are closed and head is sagging from side to side and don't intervene to make sure that the proceeding is fair.
So do any of these defendants get good representation?
I think that the trial level representation has gotten much better over the last 5 years, especially. I think that also the appellate representation has gotten better too. But the reality is that Texas is still very stingy when it comes to paying adequate resources for these cases. And so you have many cases where you have people on death row essentially because either their lawyers were incompetent or their lawyers had their hands tied behind their back.
My guest is David R. Dow, his book, The Autobiography of an Execution. It is published by 12. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you would think that if they're not getting fair trials, then many of these cases would be reversed on appeal. But your book suggests that's not true. You do write, "I'm always hopeful. Nothing ever works out, but I always think that it's going to."
Yes.
Why don't things work out?
Things don't work out because the deck is very severely stacked against death row inmates once they get convicted. And what I mean by that is that there are a wide variety of legal devices that judges on appellate courts can use in order to uphold a death sentence, even if they believe that the trial has been fundamentally unfair.
And you say that you can't accuse the state of withholding relevant evidence. That seems to me to be kind of crazy. Is that just Texas law?
No, it's not just Texas law. It's federal law. There was federal law that was enacted about 15 years ago during the Clinton administration. It's ominously titled. It's called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. And it's not only ominously titled, but appropriately titled. And that law makes it very difficult for judges to grant death row inmates new trials, even if they believe that something truly outrageous or horrible happened at the trial.
So what does that mean for your cases?
What it means in my cases is that most of my clients, no matter how hard I work on their cases, are going to get executed in accordance with the schedule that the state chooses.
You can't bring up information that's already been admitted to the court, even if it was mishandled or done in an incomplete way?
It's difficult to do that. We try, obviously. We try to think of legal theories in all of our cases that will allow us to get relief for our clients. So we certainly try, but the obstacles are numerous and those hurdles are high.
Why do you think Congress passed that law in 1996? I mean, that's before 9/11.
It was before 9/11. I think that going all the way back to the Dukakis campaign, there are some of us who remember that campaign, and I think that going all
the
way...
This is the anti-Willie Horton
Act? The anti-Willie Horton, and I think that going all the way back to the Dukakis campaign and the Willie Horton ad, there has been this notion that if you are mindful of constitutional rules and principles, it means that you're soft on crime. I think that's a false equivalence, but I think that that equivalence has really penetrated into the public discourse and including the mindset of many judges. And so I think that there's this attitude among many judges that if they are truly respectful of constitutional principles, that's equivalent to being soft on crime, and who wants to be soft on crime?
What about lawyers? Did you support the death penalty before you represented Derek Raymond?
I did. I was somewhere between a mild death penalty supporter and a death penalty agnostic. It just wasn't an issue that was very high on the list of things that I cared about. But I did believe when confronted with that case that we should not be executing people who don't have lawyers. We should not be sending people to the gurney all by themselves, leaving it to these death row inmates to navigate very complex legal procedures all by themselves. And so I worked on that case well before I was against the death penalty, and it was only by virtue of working on many of these cases that I came to develop the views about the death penalty that I currently hold.
Well, you said that in many cases, these people whose lives are on the line are incompetently served by their lawyers. You have to wonder why that is. Is it because the lawyers are overworked or, as you say, in many cases, are alcoholics? I can't believe every capital case lawyer is an alcoholic.
No, certainly not every, and maybe not.
Well, maybe it drives you to drink.
Yeah, well, it may well. It's certainly not more than a handful. I think that, as I was saying, over the last few years, the quality of representation has gotten much better. But if you look at the quality of representation 10 or 15 years ago, and many of the inmates who are coming up for execution were represented 10 or 15 years ago, the quality of representation was very poor.
How much did they know about their clients? I mean, how much can you learn about their clients other than their crimes?
One can learn a great deal about one's clients, but it is an expensive and difficult proposition. I'll just give you an example. I have a client currently who is from El Salvador. What it means for me to learn everything that I know about my client is for me to go to El Salvador, for me to have investigators go to El Salvador and interview every person who my client knew growing up, all of his teachers, all of his friends, all of his family members. That's an expensive and laborious type of investigation, and most lawyers don't want to do it.
Is that because your client did commit the crime and you're looking for extenuating circumstances?
Yes, most death row inmates did what the state accused them of doing. In perhaps.
Although it seems that more and more people are being exonerated, or we're discovering with new techniques, DNA evidence, et cetera, that quite a few people have been sentenced to death who actually didn't commit the crime.
Absolutely. And my office represented a man who had been on death row in Texas for about 15 years. And we established that he was innocent and he got out of prison, off of death row, out of prison altogether. But 90% of the people on death row did what the state accused them of doing. And what that means is that the role of the lawyer, whether it's the trial lawyer or whether it's the lawyer who works on the appeals as I do, the role of that lawyer is not to prove that the person didn't commit a crime, but simply to establish that the person shouldn't be executed, that the person should be serving some other type of sentence.
Can you briefly explain how the death penalty works from a procedural point of view?
Yes.
Who determines whether it's going to be a capital case or not?
The district attorney decides whether she or he is going to seek death in a particular case. And if the district attorney decides to seek death, then the death penalty trial has certain unique procedures associated with it by virtue of being a death penalty trial, the most important of which is that the trial is actually two trials, not just one. And at the first trial, the question that the jury is asked is whether the defendant committed the crime that the state has accused him of. And if the jury says yes, then there's a second trial. And at that second trial, the question is, should this person be executed or sentenced to something else?
Does it happen in every capital case, or do prosecutors pick and choose? Because in other, I don't know about Texas, but we have heard over the years of racial factors, whites less likely to be tried for a capital offense than blacks or Native Americans or Hispanics.
Yes. Let me mention briefly two statistics that will suggest that the death penalty regime is still deeply racist. Whites and blacks are victims of homicide in the U.S. in about equal numbers. There's 15,000 homicides a year in the U.S., and blacks and whites are victims of those homicides in about equal numbers. If you look at the people who are executed, not just in Texas, but in the U.S. as a whole, the people who are executed, 80% of them are executed for murdering somebody who's white. What that, of course, tells you is that the system we have is valuing white skin much more than it values non-white skin when it comes to identifying which people we're going to execute in Texas.
That's not a stated criterion. That's just an implied criterion.
An impermissible and offensive and outrageous criterion. In Texas, which leads the U.S. in executions, there was not a single white criminal who had been sent there for killing a black victim until 1999. And it's a case that perhaps many of your listeners have heard of, when three white guys chained a black man to the back of a pickup truck in East Texas and dragged him through the streets until he was dead. Only two of those three, by the way, got sentenced to death. The third didn't. And it was not until those two arrived on death row that there was even a single white resident of death row who had been sent there for murdering a black victim.
How much time is there in Texas between a conviction and the execution?
Well, it varies, but for people who are convicted, let's say today, I think that it's safe to say that they will be executed in 7 years or less. If you look at older convictions, the length of time on death row is a bit longer than that.
Aren't inmates sometimes put to death even when you have an appeal filed?
Yes, they can be. And the reason that they can be and the reason that they are is that the mere filing of an appeal doesn't prevent the state from moving forward with an execution. We have, in fact, had clients executed when we were in the middle of writing an appeal, in the middle of trying to file an appeal, and they were executed anyway.
My guest is David R. Dow, a university distinguished professor at the University of Houston Law Center and the litigation director at the Texas Defender Service, which is a nonprofit legal aid corporation that represents death row inmates. His latest book, your second book, right?
It's my third death penalty book.
Ah. Well, this one is called The Autobiography of an Execution, and it is published by 12. We will continue our conversation after this. Thank you. We're back with David R. Dow. His latest book, The Autobiography of an Execution, published by 12, which is an interesting publishing company. They publish 12 books a year, so you have to feel really honored to be one of those 12.
Immensely honored. I'm immensely honored.
At what point do you become involved with your clients? They've already been found guilty, haven't they, and sentenced to death?
Yes, some of the lawyers in my office work on the trials, but I personally don't work on the cases until they've been convicted and sentenced to death.
Is your job to prove their innocence or that the death penalty is too severe a punishment?
In a handful of cases, my job is to prove that they're innocent. If I, number one, believe that I can prove that they're innocent, and number two, that's a legally available option. But in most of the cases, there isn't any evidence of innocence, and even if there were, there wouldn't be a way to bring it before court, so my job is simply to get them moved off of death row.
You refer to the procedural maze you have to navigate. What does filing an appeal involve?
The mechanics of filing the appeal are, in most cases, not difficult. In this age of email, you can file most appeals by email. The difficulty is that there are relatively complicated legal restrictions on the ability of the court to grant relief. So just for example, let's suppose I file an appeal in state court and the state court rejects my appeal and says that the person is going to remain on death row, and I then want to go to federal court. I can now go to federal court, but once I'm in federal court, I have to convince the federal judge not only that the state court got the wrong answer and that my person should not be on death row, but that the answer isn't even close to correct, that it's, in the language of law, objectively unreasonable.
But you also pointed out that you can't really undo some of the damage that was done by incompetent lawyers or by mistakes in paperwork that preceded your coming on the case.
Right, and part of that difficulty is a result of the unwillingness of federal courts to be overturning death row convictions because they think that doing so is somehow a form of federal interference with state rights, or it's an intrusion into state sovereignty where the federal government ought not to be going.
A listener left a question on our show page. Is it true that two-thirds of death penalty cases are overturned on appeal?
Between 1985 and 1995, No, I'm sorry, between 1975 and 1995, it is true that two-thirds of cases were reversed on appeal. That's not an accurate Texas statistic.
And it varies from state to state, obviously.
Varies from state to state. Since 1995 to the present, it is a dramatically lower number. And one of the reasons it's a dramatically lower number is because of that statute that you and I were talking about just a moment ago.
But I'd also assume it's because certain states have pretty much eliminated the death penalty, so we're only talking about states where there's a strong belief that it is an effective means of punishment still.
There are a number of states.
I don't know how many people have been executed in New York, despite the fact that we reinstated the death penalty, but I think it's minimal number,
Number one, it's a small number, and number two, New York doesn't have a legal death penalty law anymore. The New York death penalty law was struck down by the state court, so there's not even a valid death penalty in New York anymore. But the national statistic, even when it was high everywhere. That is to say, the reversal rate was high everywhere, but over the last 10 years, it's plummeted everywhere.
And then we have the situation in the state of Illinois, which has put a moratorium on executions following an investigative report by the Chicago Tribune that showed that innocent people had been executed and that there was widespread incompetence in attorneys representing the defendants in capital cases. Has there been much call for reform in Texas as a result of that?
There certainly hasn't been any call for reform in Texas as a result of the Illinois study. There's been some call for reform in Texas as a result of investigations into a few Texas cases where there's corruption at a minimum, and it's fair to say that innocent people were probably executed. There is room for doubt because there isn't DNA proof in these cases, but I think that most reasonable observers have concluded that Texas has executed at least an innocent person or two. For reasons that escape me, those calls for reform have not really gotten a lot of traction in Texas, not nearly so much traction in Texas as they've gotten elsewhere, and I don't really know why that is.
Well, to some degree, isn't it also the positions of the governors that you've had in Texas. George Bush was many people appealed to him on certain cases, and he just ignored it. And then now you have Rick Perry, who seems to have the same policy.
Rick Perry is probably, as hard as it is to imagine, even worse than George W. Bush when it comes to not paying attention to requests for clemency. In fact, Rick Perry went against the recommendation of his own Republican-appointed clemency board in a case a month or two ago where that organization or that entity recommended relief, and Perry rebuffed them. So I think that part of the culture of Texas is that once somebody is convicted and sentenced to death, we, by golly, are going to carry out that execution come hell or high water.
Rick Perry came under some fire for changing, what was it, changing, getting rid of a commissioner in a previous death case.
Yes, there was a death row inmate by the last name of Willingham who was executed, and he was convicted of setting his house on fire and killing his family. And as it turns out, the evidence that supported the conviction, that is, the evidence that he intentionally set this fire, turned out to be junk science. And the nation's leading arson expert came to Texas to try to explain to a commission that was looking into this case why, in fact, the conviction rested on junk science, and Governor Perry disbanded the commission.
But junk science is a problem in general. You write about a man named James Grigson, is it?
Grigson.
Grigson, who was known as Dr. Death?
Yes. James Grigson would interview inmates for 10 or 15 minutes. Sometimes he wouldn't interview them at all. He would just read about them. And then he would stand up or sit down in front of the jury and testify for 4, 5, or 6 hours, telling the jury that if they didn't sentence this person to death, the person would undoubtedly kill again. And he offered such testimony, even cases of people who turned out to be innocent, who had never committed any crime at all. But he was a very effective witness, and so juries would listen to him.
Even though he had his own problems in the medical profession.
Well, he was kicked out of every professional association that he'd ever been admitted into, and the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association distanced themselves from his claimed ability to predict whether somebody was going to be dangerous in the future. But the fact that you're kicked out of a professional association doesn't mean that 12 jurors aren't going to listen to you.
My guest is David R. Dow. His book, The Autobiography of an Execution, is published by 12. So what happens when you take on a case? And I assume you ask, do you ask the new client, did you kill this person?
No, I don't ask my clients whether they killed the person. I, in general, assume that they did, and there haven't been more than a handful of cases that I've worked on where the person claimed to be innocent. In those cases, I obviously have conversations about the facts of the case. But
Henry Quake, a man you call Henry Quaker, and I don't know whether that's his real name, you felt that he was innocent.
I changed his name, and I do feel that he was innocent. He's one of the 6 or 7 clients that I've represented over the years who I believe to have been innocent. In all of the cases where I believe one of my clients to have been innocent, however, there isn't any DNA evidence, and so I can't prove it to the satisfaction of people who insist on DNA evidence before they admit that an innocent person has been on death row.
But in the case of Henry Quaker, there was little evidence against him as well. Doesn't that count?
It should count. It should certainly count at the trial. The problem is that once you get convicted, all of the things that you think should count, they begin to count much less and perhaps not at all. So I think that if Henry Quaker had had a competent trial lawyer, he would never have been convicted. But once you're convicted, it's exceedingly difficult to undo the conviction.
What about when people confess? We've heard of cases where, well, people claim that they were coerced into confessing, but we've also heard of some people who will claim responsibility for crimes that we know they couldn't have committed.
Yes, I had a client who at one point claimed responsibility for 25 or 30 murders, and it so happens that some of those murders were happening at the same time.
Henry the serial killer.
Serial killers are a perfect example, and so I think that there's this phenomenon of confessing to crimes that one doesn't commit. But the confession point is an important point because you were talking earlier about DNA exonerations. If we have a DNA exoneration, we know, to the extent that human beings can be certain about anything, that the person did not commit the crime.
And except yet, in the O.J. case.
Except in the O.J. case. But O.J. notwithstanding, in those DNA exonerations, in 1/4 of those cases, the person confessed to the crime. So you have somebody confess to a crime, and then years later, using DNA, we find that it was impossible for the person to have committed the crime.
There was a case of a man whose daughter had claimed that she'd been witness to satanic killings in Oregon, and she named her father as being part of the group that did it. He, for some reason, confessed, even though it later turned out nothing of the sort had happened. And while others who had been accused got out, they were reluctant to let him out because he had confessed, and they didn't want to free a man who had confessed to a crime, even though it was obvious he didn't commit it.
Yes, the psychology of false confessions is, I think, very difficult for people really to get their minds around because it's hard for anyone to imagine confessing to a crime that you didn't do.
In the case of Henry Quaker, didn't you get useful information about his case from another inmate?
Yes, we got useful information about his case from another inmate, from guards in the prison, from police officers who had investigated the case. So we had a pretty significant amount of evidence that was useful in the case.
Usually when inmates participate, they are they're actually acting as state's witnesses, and then there's the question of whether they were offered a lighter sentence. What happens when somebody says, well, actually, he told me that, or I believe he didn't commit the crime?
One always has to wonder about the motivations of inmates. If inmates think that they have something to be gained from telling a certain story, one has to at least be alert to the possibility that they're telling the story because of that. So whenever we talk to people who are incarcerated, the first thing that we try to think about is how the inmate who's talking to us could be using that story to help himself.
Now, I don't want to reveal what happened in the Quaker case, but often, despite the fact that you really have a strong case, you don't win. Do you ever feel like you're wasting your time?
I feel like I'm wasting my time virtually every day. When in those moments when I'm measuring whether my time is well spent or wasted by whether I ultimately get my client off of death row, it's difficult to resist the conclusion that I'm wasting my time. I have to end up focusing on other aspects of why I find the work rewarding to reach a different conclusion.
And if you get them off death row, would they just put into another part of the prison and kept in without parole, life without parole?
Yes, unless I can establish that they're innocent, which we've done in one case recently. What it means when I succeed is that my clients get moved off of death row and get put in what's called general prison population.
Aren't you really fighting against the tide? You describe judges in Texas Federal Court of Appeals as utterly unprincipled and hostile to the rule of law.
Yes. Yes, I think
you're going to really, they're going to really be happy to see you the next time you show up in their courtroom.
Well, somebody was asking me recently about whether I'm burning some bridges here with this book. The truth is, I'm not saying anything that I haven't said before. And as I told the person who asked me, they can only kill my clients once, you know, and they're already killing all of them. So it's hard for me to see how they can do anything worse to my clients than they're already doing to them.
We hear often about activist judges, usually describing liberal judges. What about judges where you kind of know that they're going to, deny your appeal?
I think
are they being activists?
I think that's an apt characterization. I think that many of the judges who I confront are Republican-appointed judges who would distance themselves from the label judicial activist, but what I see them doing is going to great lengths and great machinations in order to reach a result that they want to reach, even when if they were following legal rules and principles strictly, they would reach a contrary conclusion.
How are death penalty lawyers viewed in the Texas legal community?
Well, that is an excellent question. I think that they're obviously viewed well in the defense bar. Our clients like us. But there's a lot of hostility from other quarters. There's hostility from judges, which is perplexing because judges should understand the importance of having aggressive and effective representation in death penalty cases. And there's certainly some hostility from people who post comments on the newspaper's websites and things like that. I think that the healthiest thing for a death penalty lawyer in Texas is not to read the comments on the websites.
So Texas is worse than some other places in this regard, which would suggest to me that it's unlikely that you, even if you could propose laws, that they would ever be enacted.
I don't know if I would say that Texas is worse than other places. I think that what Texas has in common with all other places is this false belief that the people who inhabit death row, not only in Texas but elsewhere, are these Hannibal Lecter-like inhuman monsters. And the reality is very different. And I do think that if even those people who were posting comments on the websites could visit death row and see for themselves that their viewpoint is wrong, that some of them would change their minds.
You talk a lot in this book about your son and your wife. We have very few moments. Yes. But does this take a toll on them as well?
It does take a toll on them. I think that they're both very patient to allow me to continue doing this work, but it's hard when you spend all day at death row visiting murderers and then you want to come home and play a game of Scrabble with your wife and son.
David R. Dow's latest book is The Autobiography of an Execution. It is published by 12. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. You could always move to New York. You won't have the problem.
I certainly wouldn't have this particular problem. I might have others, but thank you for having me.